Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Okay, here we go. Another edition of Hollywood and Levine. I am Ken Levine, your podcast host. And this week, I want to talk about the business of television because it is changing, and it is changing so quickly. There are so many more opportunities, but there's a lot of things that are in flux. It really is the wild, wild west out there. And to help make some sense of it, I am bringing back a guest that I had back in January of 2018, Preston Beckman. Now, Preston Beckman is a media consultant and the chairman of the Beckman Group. And for 20 years, he was at NBC, and he was there during the great must-see TV era. Also spent 15 years at Fox. And you may know him on Twitter as the Masked Scheduler. Anyway, he knows a lot about the business. And like I said, we're going to try to make some sense of it this week here on Hollywood and Levine. Well, first of all, welcome back. You were here a couple of years ago, and the industry has completely changed in 2 years. So in 2 years, I'll have you back, and we'll talk about the new industry. But, you know, one thing I always tell my students when I'm teaching a class is, in addition to learning how to be a good writer, learn the business, because it is changing so much and so quickly. And now there are all these different platforms. So I thought, well, let's talk a little bit about the platforms. Let's start with broadcast. I mean, it used to be such an easy equation in that they made their money from advertising. And so the more viewers, the higher ratings they had, the more they could charge and the more money they could make. But they also couldn't own shows. And then suddenly they could own shows, and that really changed things, didn't it?
Yes, I really believe it did. There was still a period of time where I think we were putting on what we felt were the best shows, regardless of the studios. There was still a lot of relationships that went on. There was still a lot of efforts to leverage the successful shows to get other shows on one schedule. Paramount did a lot of that. Warner Brothers did a lot of that when I was at NBC. But as the networks started to own more and more of their product, I think it became very clear to us that that was the priority, was to put on the programs that you owned, because it didn't only benefit the network, hopefully, but it benefited the studio. And therefore, the way to evaluate the success of a show had more to do with the overall revenue that the show would bring in and less about the revenue, the sales revenue that the show would bring in. When I worked at Fox, they were the last, I think, to really embrace that model. And mm-hmm. We were oftentimes accused of not being able to do our jobs by Rupert Murdoch because we were putting on all these studio shows, and the studios were charging us ridiculous license fees, which is what you pay for an episode to air two episodes, two runs of a show, where we couldn't make profits off of certain shows. But the studios, bottom line, looked phenomenal.
Well, and the other thing, too, is by owning shows, it meant that you could sell them into syndication. I mean, Warner Brothers is making fortunes on Friends, but now the syndication model has kind of changed because, you know, it used to be you'd have a hit show like, say, Cheers, and you would sell it into syndication to all of these local stations in Akron, Ohio, places like that. But now they don't have exclusivity anymore because it's also on all of these cable channels and things. So, you know, the old model was if you had 100 episodes, you crossed the River Jordan and everyone got rich. That's not the case anymore, though, is it?
No, and not only that, but it used to be that it would take about 4 years for a show to be on the air.
Right, like 25 episodes a year.
Yeah, to go into syndication. That changed at some point where either shows would air simultaneously on the broadcast network, and cable channels often owned by the same entity. You would see that after a year, some shows would move over to other platforms. So the whole notion that for the first 4 years of a show, if you wanted to see it, you could only see it on broadcast or maybe DVD, you know, DVDs. That started to change where you knew that even if you didn't DVR the show, that very quickly it would be available all over the place.
Right. And there's the other conflict of interest issue, like say with MASH, where MASH was drawing big money in syndication, but Fox, that owned it at the time, was launching their FX network, and they wanted something to be able to launch it with.
Yes.
So they put MASH on, which certainly devalued it in syndication, and all of the profit participants of MASH, like Alan Alda, were getting hurt, but the studio profited because they were launching their network and they were making all the money on the advertising.
It got a little shady. I mean, you know, we would claim that we were always, we meaning whether it was Fox or NBC, would claim that we were taking the profit participants' interests into account. I don't know. Clearly the goal was we owned these things, and what used to be broadcast television became part of something a lot larger.
Right.
And it was, how can we maximize the benefit to us of these entities? I mean, look, I think one of the most interesting moments for me was when Disney pulled or said they were going to pull all the Marvel shows from Netflix.
Right.
That was a really interesting moment, because I remember when they made that announcement, it was like, okay. And by the way, not only Disney, but, you know, you started to see a moment where all of the studios that owned product were saying to Netflix, you're not getting it anymore. You know, where are you going to start using it? And, you know, you could see that Netflix realized, well, it's time for us to start investing in original programming, because we're not going to live off of the success of the Offices and the Friends and, you know, all those shows. And that was that moment in the history of the business where, you started to get the sense that ownership became everything. And it was no longer about where can we get the best deal. It was like, how can we build up the properties and the platforms that are under our umbrella?
Yeah, I maintain that the reason Disney bought 20th Century Fox was for their library. so that they would be able to own it and be able to show it on Disney Plus. And like you said, with the streaming networks, and we can get into that in a couple of minutes, but, you know, Netflix, you know, drew such a huge following because it had pretty much everything. And so for $12.99 a month, you could watch anything. Well, now there's HBO Max and Amazon Prime and Disney Plus and Paramount Plus and Peacock and on and on and on. And there's, you know, all this competition. So it seems like, boy, that's the new future of television, is the streaming services. But in 2-3 years, you figure you can't have 10 of these all survive. People aren't going to pay $12.95 to 10 of these, maybe 2 or 3. So I imagine there's going to be a lot of mergers and consolidation, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of look at there are the Netflix and the Disney Pluses of the world that I think will survive. And then there's a whole level below them that are going to fight it out. And, you know, look, here, one of the realities of life is there's only 24 hours a day. That doesn't change. It's never going to change. So there's only so much time you can watch television. And at some point, I think that what's driving some of the streaming services, once you've consumed these shows, you're going to go, okay, either I will drop it or I will only come back if there's another season. So I think there's going to be a shakeup. I also think that everybody knows right now they have to get in the pool.
Right.
You know, this business, and I've been in it, you know, I've been involved with it for almost 40 years, I think, is always about, we don't know if this makes sense, but we've got to do it. And then we'll figure out if it makes any sense.
Right.
And usually what happens is at some point, and I always talk about this on my Twitter feed, at some point it starts to look a lot like the way it used to look. You know, and I think what's happening now is, you know, you have the broadcast networks and now you have the streaming services. And, you know, they're going to be the high-rated streaming services or the highly subscribed, and then there are going to be the lesser ones, and some of those will survive and some of them won't. But what they all need is product and content, and that's what's exploding right now.
And I think that my prediction is that the model will flip, whereas now CBS will premiere its show on its broadcast network, and then it will go to Paramount Plus or whatever streaming service they own. And I think in the future it's going to be the opposite, that the shows are going to premiere on Paramount Plus, and then, you know, for the few stragglers who still don't have it, it'll go on their broadcast network a few months later.
Or people will go, well, I know it's coming on the broadcast network a few months later, I can wait.
Exactly.
Yeah, because, I mean, most shows aren't, you know, must see. I have to see them right now.
Mm-hmm.
If they are, you'll subscribe. But if they're not, you know, and everybody might have their 2 or 3, but not hundreds. I find it humorous that as someone who spent 25 years of their career in scheduling, and people would go, well, you know, scheduling's dead, linear is dead. I think what you're about to see is the evolution of scheduling, where the people who are doing it at the networks can easily be hired to do it at companies where, okay, here's what we have. How do we maximize this? Do we start on the network? Do we start on a cable channel? Do we start on our streaming service? Once we start on the streaming service, where does it go next? So there's a whole, I think there's a job for people who know how to strategize, put it all together, and maximize the revenue and the benefits that they'll get from the shows. I don't think it's going to look a lot different from the way it may have looked 30 years ago. It's just going to be less about ratings and more about maximizing revenue, maximizing subs, and things like that.
There's also so much more product out there now. Mm-hmm. And that's got to be a big challenge for anybody who is, say, scheduling Netflix, because there's so many shows. You know, I remember as a producer having shows on CBS and NBC and always fighting to get promos to be noticed. And that's among a crop of 10 new shows. And, you know, Netflix is putting up 30 new shows a month, and documentaries and shows from Britain and shows from Copenhagen. And it's like, my God, how do you get sampled?
Well, I don't think they care. I mean, I really think it's about, as long as you're giving them the $12.99, $14.99 a month, they don't really care what you're watching.
No, they don't. But as the producer, I do. Oh,
yeah, well, too bad.
Yeah.
But I mean, they have the metrics, they know. But, you know, it's interesting how many shows on Netflix drop and you've never heard of them. You know nothing about them. And all of a sudden, you know, on social media, you start hearing about Tiger King, or you start hearing about some other real crime documentary that they did. And then that's what they're hoping, is that something resonates. And then the audience is the marketer of the show, as opposed to historically, okay, you know, how do we launch a schedule? So a lot of the, I mean, and, you know, we just started watching Call My Agent, which has been on Netflix for quite a while. I think it's in its fourth season now on mm-hmm. Netflix. We didn't know about it. You know, how do we find, you know, I saw it was sitting there, you know, I go on Netflix and there it was. I didn't even look at what it was. And then, you know, we start to hear about it from people we know. And I think that's the way it works now. It's not about fighting for marketing, because they don't really promote everything. And even the way they promote it is differently. You know, you get emails. There's all kinds of ways in which you find out what's going on, you know, what's coming on. And you do your own work in finding out. You know, you go on certain websites, what's coming on these.
Right.
So it's just it's a different way. But it used to be, as you well know, opening night, you know, you'd promote something, you'd wake up the next morning, you'd see the ratings, you have some idea about how it's going to do. You'd have to wait a few weeks, but you have some idea. I don't think that's not the model anymore. If there's anything called opening night, it's like, how many subs do you get within the first 2 or 3 weeks when you drop a streaming service? So you're marketing the service and not the shows.
So among the viewers of a Netflix or a Hulu, would you say that primarily they are watching the new product, or are they watching reruns of Golden Girls and Full House and The Office? It seems to me that whatever the highest rated show is on Netflix, probably more people were watching Friends on Netflix back when Friends was on Netflix.
I can't tell you I have data. I can tell you anecdotally that I've always believed that what drives the success of streaming services are the same shows that drove the success of the broadcast networks. I mean, you actually saw it, you still see it in syndication, where you'd look at what the top rated shows are in syndication on any given day. And still, the, you know, the Big Bang Theory and CIS, shows like that. So the hits are the hits. And, you know, the really good hits, especially the ones that are more episodic rather than serialized, go on forever. And, you know, when I started the business, one of the first day parts when that term existed that I worked with in research was Saturday morning. And I always found it interesting that the most successful Saturday morning show was Bugs Bunny. It was repeats of all those Bugs Bunny.
Right.
And, you know, you start to realize that every 5 years you repopulate the audience for a show like that. And I think it's the same thing with shows like Friends, especially a show like Friends, where, you know, you go through life and you're repopulating who are the 20-somethings now. Well, now I'm 20-something. I can look at it with a different set of eyes than when I was 10, you know, because Friends was always the show of either I want to be them, I am them, or I remember being them. So as you go through life, you can watch Friends. Same thing with The Office. You know, most of us have worked in environments like that. So those things are universal, and I still believe that that's what's driving viewership. Also, I find it interesting on Netflix that more and more shows on Netflix feel like they could have been on broadcast networks, as opposed to these esoteric, off-the-wall kind of shows. There's a show called Virgin River, which is the classic fish out of water romance kind of thing. And, you know, there's Magnolias, something around Steel Magnolias, or another show on Netflix that's the same idea of women who are friends who live in a small town. And I watch those shows. My wife loves them, and we watch them, and I go, this is exactly what we used to watch on broadcast television. And those states. So that's why I keep going back to what worked 35 years ago is still what's going to work today.
Well, what's interesting is since the networks started owning shows, they obviously had a lot more influence, and their notes became mandatory notes. And you would think over the years, as network ratings are eroding, as audiences are going elsewhere, that at least they would ease up on that and offer at least a place for creative people to have some creative freedom. And instead, it's just getting worse and worse. And you think to yourself, okay, as you know, if I were still a 35-year-old producer, showrunner, and I wanted to get a show on the air, I wouldn't go to CBS first. I wouldn't go to them until I've already gone to Hulu and Netflix and Amazon and Spectrum and everywhere else. I just don't understand why the networks continue to have this chokehold on creative people when all it's doing is driving away viewers and creative people.
Wow. Well, first of all, I think over the last few years, you started to see the coalescence of program executives that were used to be, even if it was a Fox studio show, there would be network program at current executives, and there would be Fox studio current executives. So you would be getting notes from two different people or, you know, sources. That's sort of going away. And you're seeing that there's only one voice at a production, an entity, whether it's Fox or whatever. So that's going away. There are still restraints to broadcast television that don't exist on these other services. You know, there's still a standards department. There's still a sales department for what, you know. So there are still issues that have to be dealt with at a broadcast network that are not necessarily the case.
That's true, but that's always been the case. What I'm talking about is, you know, back in the Pleistocene era, you know, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, writer would come in and would pitch a show to a network, and the network would say, okay. And then the writer would come in a week later and pitch out the story outline, and the network would say, okay, write a first draft. You write a first draft, you get notes, you do a second draft, and they pick you up or they don't. Now, you have to go in with this huge pitch, and if they pick you up, then you have to write this like one page document of the basic beats of the outline. That has to be approved by 15 other people. Then when that is done, you have to write like a 15 page outline, and that gets revised 17 times. And then you write the first draft and get notes from a million people, and on and on. I mean, it's just mind-numbing now. And I think to myself, you know, if I'm Netflix, if I'm Hulu, and there's a writer who I trust, and I say, yeah, I'm not going to pay as much, and not as many people potentially will see it, but you can go off and do your own show, I'm going to get that producer coming over to Hulu.
Yeah, well, I don't know what to say to that other than, you know, that there are different constraints. Hulu and Netflix still rely on the subs. So, you know, it's not going to be about limiting the content in any way. It's going to be, is this bringing in subscribers? Now, a lot of those shows won't. You know, there is something to be said for taking a creative, we might disagree on this, taking a creative idea and saying, well, this is how you're going to get more people to watch it. You know, I mean, the history that I know of the business is how many times someone at a network came up with an idea. I mean, look, Friends, Warren Littlefield made some suggestions in that show. You know, Will and Grace started in a different direction. And again, there were some suggestions made by the networks, which I think made it a better show. So I don't think it's a blanket, like, here's my idea. You know, here's what I want to do. Okay, go and do it.
Well, I'm all for the best idea wins. And I'm also all for suggestions. Mm-hmm. But there's a difference between saying, you know what might be good is if you tried that, and you think, hey, you know what, that's a good idea. And by the way, there have been along my journey some very good, smart people who have offered really good notes along the way. And to them, I'm very grateful and acknowledge Tim Stack and a number of people. But it just seems like there's so many notes and, you know, not to belabor the point, but you would think that when the networks are having their retreats at La Costa or whatever, and they're going, okay, so what do we do for this season, that somebody might say, you know, we're not getting the best ideas. They're not coming to us first. What can we do to entice the creative community to come back to us with their ideas and not go to Hulu with their ideas first?
Well, I think that the networks are now, you know, the networks used to be on top. They were on top.
They could do anything, yep.
Now they're part of something. So you can go to Paramount Plus, let's say, and pitch an idea. You're going to pitch it to an entity that might say to you, this platform makes the most sense for this idea. And you could wind up on CBS. See what I mean?
Okay.
So you're not pitching to FX or USA Network or NBC. You're pitching to Comcast. You're pitching to something bigger than what you and I are, how we grew up in the business, so to speak. And you may find yourself where you didn't think you were going to wind up, because they might go, well, this is an idea that we feel will help us on this platform. And, you know, or they'll say, well, you know, we're going to put you on this platform and this platform. But in between, you know, you might have to edit, make some changes when we go over to this platform.
Right.
I mean, you've been seeing it with being a big pro wrestling fan, you're seeing it with what Peacock and the WWE are now doing now that the WWE is over on Peacock. And they're going, okay, we're taking your product and we're editing it, you know? Right. So I don't know if it's like, oh, why? I don't know if the broadcast networks are necessarily going, why aren't we getting the best ideas? I think the ideas are now not coming to a platform. They're coming to a larger entity.
Fair enough.
You know.
Yeah, fair enough. You know, you mentioned the USA Network, and it seems to me that these cable networks like Bravo and USA and everything, boy, they're kind of getting squeezed out between broadcast and streaming. Why bring a show to the USA Network?
But I'll say it again, you know, but you'd be bringing it to Comcast. Right. I'll give you an example.
But is the USA Network going to survive? Are those things going to go away?
I think they will for now. I mean, you know, they have a dual revenue stream.
Mm-hmm.
It's more about when will cable systems say start dropping them and saying we're paying you, you know, 40 cents a sub. You're not worth 40 cents a sub to me anymore. You're worth 10 cents a sub. I mean, look, one of the reasons why broadcast networks survive is because of retransmission fees. You know, they used to have broadcast networks were a single revenue stream, advertising.
Mm-hmm.
Now they go to their affiliates, and the affiliates are paid by the cable systems to carry the affiliate, and the affiliate then takes the money and it comes to the network. So the networks now have a second revenue stream, which allows them to survive. So I believe, and I'm seeing it, I've been working with Discovery on the launch of Discovery Plus. And, you know, we talk about this all the time because they have all these channels. And it's interesting to see how this whole thing is going to fit together because they're very popular channels. And it's a tightrope to figure out what goes over to the streaming service. When does it go over to streaming service? What should stay on the Food Network or HGTV? So there's all these. That's why I go back to I think we're in the infancy of all this, and I think it's going to take. And I know of one service, I won't say which actually approached me about coming over there to schedule this service. And I told them, no, but I congratulate you for understanding that you need a strategy and you need to figure out, you need someone who's going to help to put it all together for you.
On the other hand, yes, it's the Wild West,
yes.
But isn't it fun?
It's always been, yeah, I mean, this business has never stopped evolving for
right.
me, and I'm sure for you. And I find it fascinating. I really do. And at the end of the day, it comes back to the same thing. You've got to tell good stories. You know, I've always said, you know, when I was at NBC or even at Fox, I would say this, there were three things. There's the show, there's the scheduling, and there's the marketing. And I would always say the show is on top. Then I would say the scheduling, then the marketing is where.
Sure, you would. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think it's the scheduling anymore. I think it's the marketing. But the show is still, it all comes down to find that. Now, what I find unsettling is how much of what we see now is what we've already seen. You know, reboots and reimaginings,
mm-hmm.
and this, you know, and as I call the colonized hits, you know, the CSIs, the Law and Orders, the, you know, so I think what the laziness of the business is what I find, if anything, upsetting in that, you know, it's like, okay, it's hard to, as you said before, it's hard to market these shows, but if I say it's Law and Order colon, I can go Law and Order colon hairdresser, you know,
right?
CSI Cohen Sheboygan, you know. So I think that's a little lazy, and it's still what really breaks out is what's never been done before. What's been done I mean, the basic idea is there, but it's a new way to do it, a creative way to do it, or a character that you've never seen before. So it still comes down to somebody coming in and pitching and having people smart enough to know that they're giving me a gift here. And
You have to have some new product. Otherwise, you just become an oldies station.
Yeah, or a clean, or a classy looking old, the same stuff with just, you know, different titles.
I mean, right. So, cover versions of the same oldies.
That's what if anything, I don't say, I mean, I'm removed from the business a bit now, but it's not the fun thing is I roll my eyes almost every day when I go, oh God, so you're doing another one of these, or you're reviving this, or it didn't work the first time and you're doing it. That's really kind of concerns me. But, you know, when somebody comes in and pitches that stuff, or if Dick Wolf says, you know, I've got a fifth one order for you, you're not going to say no. But at some point, it all feels the same.
Well, it's the same thing in the feature world where it's just franchises and sequels and things because the audience is familiar with it. And I think when there is so much product out there, I think the audience probably clings to the familiar even more.
Well, it's easier to know what you're getting rather than, you know, take
right.
the dollars.
Right. You know. And like you said, only 24 hours a day, only so much time you can watch television, and you don't want to spend it devoting time to shows where you watch it for an hour and you go, nah, I'm never watching this again.
Right, exactly. Or, you know, or there's, that's why when I was in the business, I always avoided or never supported putting science fiction on the air because so much of sci-fi is, here's something, I'm not going to tell the audience what it is, and you'll have to go along with this for a couple episodes, and then I'm going to tell you what it is, and more likely than not, you're going to roll your eyes and say, that makes no sense, goodbye, you know? Mm-hmm. And if you weren't there from the beginning, you're going to be completely confused. So, right, you know, as opposed to, you know, Law and Order, Organized Crime, or whatever they're about to put on the air, or White Collar Crime, or I can't remember which one it is. I know who the character is, and I know what the stories are going to be, and they're going to be resolved one way or the other in 60 minutes.
Well, this has been fascinating, and like I say, we'll talk again in 2 years when it's a completely different model, and it's all holograms all the time.
All right, and I'm going to go off and watch King Kong versus Godzilla.
That's right, when people will be watching from the chips that are implanted in their brain from taking the vaccine.
There'll probably be a mood thing where I sit down in front of the TV and there's sensors and they go, I know exactly what you want to watch.
Right. That's right.
Yeah.
I'm going to tune on the Incredulous channel tonight.
Yeah. It's
Preston, thanks so much. This has always been great. Love talking to you.
Take care.
Okay, there you go. Preston Beckman, my guest this week on Hollywood and Levine. Thanks so much for listening. As always, our thanks to Adam and Susie Meister-Butler, to Howard Hoffman, John Wolfert, Bruce, and Jason Miller. My email address, should you want to get in touch with me for any reason, it's HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. That's HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. I'm on Twitter @KenLevine. I am also on Instagram, Hollywood and Levine. Please subscribe if you haven't. Please stay safe. Get vaccinated when you can. And I'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
Hollywood and Levine.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.